You are listening to The World Cafe. Not to be too grandiose about it, but our guest today, the British folk singer Shirley Collins, has been a servant of folk songs, mostly from the UK, some collected in her native Sussex, and everywhere throughout her life. Today we'll hear songs from Lodestar that had their origins in the U.S., including a Cajun song. Born in 1935, in the 60s through the 70s, she made some iconic recordings on her own and with her sister Dorothy Collins.
It was round and about last Martinmas tide, when the green leaves were swelling, that young Jimmy Grove of the West Country fell in love with Barbary Allen.
She also recorded with her then-husband Ashley Hutchings in the Albion Country Band. And then in 1982, she stopped singing, struck by dysphonia, an inability to sustain singing while in a production at the National Theater. The causes certainly had to do with heartbreak. In the time she didn't sing, she did many things until about a year ago when she was persuaded to start singing again. And she will sing for us today, again in service to the songs. Shirley Collins, I am delighted that you are here with us today, and congratulations on Lodestar. What or who persuaded you to sing again?
It's a long story, really. It's about 20 years ago that musician David Tibbett was in touch with me when I wasn't doing any singing at all and said that he'd loved my albums and could he come and meet me. And we formed a sort of good friendship. And over 20 years, he kept asking if I would sing. And for the first 5 years, I said, absolutely not. For the next 5 years, I said, well, I might. But then when it came to it, I chickened out. And then over the next 5 years, it was the same thing. Then 18 months ago, he said, would I sing two songs at a concert he was giving in London? And I said yes, and actually turned up and did it. That was the start of it, and it's all sort of grown since then. You know, it's snowballed.
Was it a relief when you found that you could go through it and do it?
Yes, it was. What was great about it for me is that I suddenly felt I was myself again. I felt that I was Shirley Collins once more, because all the time I hadn't been singing, it was a different person, really.
Mm. That's a really, really interesting point, to go off, sort of have a entire period of your life as a different person. And now, during that period, I'm interested, did you try singing and were not able to, or you didn't even want to approach it?
Well, it ended up like not wanting to try, because every time, you know, before that, when I sang, even indoors, I just couldn't bear the sound of my voice, or I, you know, croaked, and I had no faith in myself at all as a singer then. And it was too humiliating, David. That was the thing, you know, and perhaps I shouldn't have been quite so vain. But I'd been able to sing once and now I couldn't. And it just hurt too much. And I just had to retreat from it, withdraw from it. But now that it's sort of back, I can forgive myself.
Who are some of the singers in something approaching the genre that you're in, or other singers that you really admire?
Well, I love Nick Jones.
It's of a fair and handsome girl, she's all in her tender years.
I like John Kirkpatrick. These might not be names that you know in the States.
Young man from hunting, faint and weary. Oh, what ails my lord, my dearie?
Perhaps Linda Thompson, dear. Richard Thompson, you know, both wonderful singers.
Come the night, you're only what I want.
But the singers that I listen to mostly now are the field recordings, the singers that were recorded from the 1950s on, both in England and in the States. And that's the music I really love best, and the music that I try not to copy, but to sing as those people did, you know, straightforwardly, no embroidery, no dressing up the songs, you know, no, they're just singing you a song as they have heard it in the past, you know, picked up and learned by heart from somebody else. And it seems to me that's the very best way to do it, in that time-honored and old-fashioned way of just, you know, passing these songs down through generations.
These words were composed by Spencer the Rover, who traveled Great Britain and most parts of Wales. He had been so reduced,
which caused great confusion,
and that was the reason he went on the roam.
Tell our audience about Sussex and what is special about it in terms of music and just in terms of where you live.
Well, in terms of music, it's the home of possibly, well, definitely the most famous of the singing families in the country. That's the Copper family of Rotting Dean, a village by on the sea, on the coast above Great Chalk Cliffs. And they have been in that part of Sussex for over 400 years, just being farmers and working the land. And they passed songs down through generations and still do. I mean, even the infants are singing now, you know, the two-year-olds pipe away. And they had a huge influence on English music as well, because they had a huge repertoire of songs.
The brought tears in their eyes, which made him lament.
Sussex, well, it's my favourite county. I mean, we have the Great Downs, the South Downs here, which are great sweeps of land that move towards the sea, where you really do have the highest white cliffs. And the turf is so springy underfoot. You can walk there, you know, for hours and hours and not feel tired at all. It's full of skylarks, and it's got hawthorn trees as well that are blown and shaped by prevailing westerly wind. And it's just home for me. You know, I can't be away from it for too long.
This is probably a big question. I don't know how far back it would go, but do you remember when you first became aware of the folk songs of Sussex or of your area, and what was your reaction?
Well, I mean, right from the start, Dolly and I, during the Second World War, we slept in our grandparents' air raid shelter, and they would sing to us at night, Granny and Grandad. And Grandad sang what I learned later were folk songs from Sussex. And there was always that feeling of security when he was singing, you know. And once I'd realised that what they were, and I went on to listen more and more, it just became so just an absolutely essential part of my life then, that you know, I was surrounded by these songs. And when I moved to London to go to libraries to try and find more songs in books, it was when I was there that I realised that there were field recordings I could listen to that had been made in the 1950s. And so I started to listen, and mostly from, you know, from my part of the country, from the southeast. And it just became, I don't know, just absolutely the most essential part of my life then, that I specialised as much as I could in songs from Sussex. Mm. Part of the reason was that I was fortunate that my grandparents sang to me, because I loved listening to older, unaccompanied voices. And, of course, when you're listening to a field recording, in England especially, that nothing is accompanied, you just get the voice. And so that those recordings didn't sound strange to me or boring or anything, and whereas some of the young singers I know found it very difficult to listen to unaccompanied singing like that, especially with older voices. But I was used to it, and I loved it. It was a huge advantage, actually. I was very lucky.
Contented he'll stay and go a-rambling no more.
Two of the loves of your life have been extremely important to music. One was the song collector Alan Lomax. And did you meet through music?
Well, yes, I did. I had moved to London when I was sort of 19 or 20, and Ewan McColl, the British singer, was giving a party for Alan. Now, Alan was coming back to London after spending about 5 years recording in the field in Spain and in Italy. And I met Alan at this party, and I sorry, but I always tell it the same way because this is how it is, that I walked in the door and there was this big, burly Texan with big, you know, rugged shoulders and a big head of shaggy, dark hair. And he looked like an American bison to me, which is my favourite animal. And I just always thought of him as that. And I'm afraid I fell in love on the spot.
That's fantastic.
As one does from time to time.
Yes, rarely, but yes.
Rarely, yes, but it happened then.
Well, you went on with him on his travels to collect some music in the U.S. In fact, if I'm right, you collected the version of Pretty Polly that is on Lodestar?
Absolutely, I collected it. And this is one that I recorded myself.
Way down in the Lonely Valley, Pretty Polly did dwell. Who was courted by Captain, who loved her so well. Her father and mother came this far to know, and departed Pretty Polly and her own true love.
Alan had gone into we were in Timbo in Arkansas, and pioneering spirit still prevailed. I mean, women served the men their dinner first and then the women ate after the men had eaten. So Alan was in a side room having had his dinner and he was drinking Oscar Gilbert's moonshine. And Ollie, Oscar's wife, was in the side room with me, and Alan had given me the tape recorder that day to, he said, just get as much from Ollie as you can, you know. And I hit it off so well with Ollie, you know, we chatted away like mad, and because we had so much in common with the songs, you know, because I knew a lot of the songs that she sang, I knew the English versions of them, and she was fascinated by that. And then she sang this lovely, lovely ballad, Pretty Polly, which started off in England as a song called Polly Oliver, and in the States it's Pretty Polly.
What news from your country? What news do I hear?
And what I loved about this as well, and I found it really tricky when we were singing it, she sang, when she was talking about United States, she said New United States. She put an N in front of it. And then there's this wonderful long line that says, I'm a New United States soldier from George Washington, I came. And you have to fit all those notes into a line that really doesn't have quite enough notes to do it. But I just loved the way she did it, and I just had to do it the same way that she did. You know, there was no help for that. You had to do what Ollie did because she was just perfect.
I'm a United States soldier from George Washington, I came. I fight for my liberty by sea and by land. If you be my captain, I'll be your command.
Well, tell you what, let's hear you fit all those in. Can you do a version of Pretty Polly?
Yes. I've got Ian Keary with me. He's playing guitar on this one. No, he's not. He's playing the instrument, yes.
Wait a second. The instrument?
The instrument is an instrument that I had made in 1962, I think, by a maker, John Bailey, here in London. I'd got a Victorian five-string banjo neck, and I gave it to him and said, you know, would you please put a sort of beautiful, attach it to a beautiful body? And he did a half dulcimer shape, so it's sort of a long heart-shaped instrument. And it's so pretty, beautiful wood, and it makes this really sweet chiming sound.
Our guest is Shirley Collins, and this is her doing the song Pretty Polly.
List for a soldier and follow my love.
She went to the stable, 6 horses she found, and saddled a mare could travel the ground. And with a brace of pistols swung by her side, like a United States soldier, Pretty Polly did ride. She rode till she come to the town, and there she the crown. Now the first inn she met with was an English old lord, and the next inn was Captain Pretty Polly's true love. What news in the country, what news do I hear? She handed him a letter from Polly, oh dear. He opened the letter, 2 pages he saying Polly is a soldier with a man all around. Now Polly being weary, she hung down her head, and she called for a candle to light her to bed. The captain, he said, I've a bed at my ease, and you may lie with me, kind sir, if you please. Well, to lie with a captain is to lie with a king. I'm a United States soldier from George Washington, I came. I'll fight for my liberty by sea and by land. If you'll be my captain, I'll be your command. She left her old parents to weep and to mourn, saying, Polly, oh Polly, when will you return?
Our guest today, Shirley Collins, singing Pretty Polly live. More with her coming up as we switch up the story to talk about her time in the U.S., chasing folk songs and discovering Mississippi Fred McDowell with folklorist Alan Lomax when we continue on The World Cafe. I'm David Dye, second half of my interview with 81-year-old British folk singer Shirley Collins, who went through a period of being unable to sing but has returned to performing with the new album Lodestar, her first in almost 40 years. In 1958, Collins traveled to the U.S. with her then-love folklorist Alan Lomax and, among other things, met bluesman Mississippi Fred McDowell when he was just a farmer walking across the field.
I did, and I mean, this is one of the great meetings of my life, and I still have as clear a picture of the day I met him as I did all those years ago. We'd been recording in Como in northern Mississippi. Some people, Sid Hemphill, as a blind singer that Alan had recorded back in the 1940s, and he wanted to go back to see him in 1959 to see, you know, just to see how he was. And Sid introduced us to other singers in the neighbourhood and said, you know, we really ought to hear this blues singer, Fred McDowell. And one evening we were recording in a clearing in the woods, surrounded by, you know, the wooden shacks, the wooden huts where the people lived, and there were hens scratching around in the dust, and there were kids running around and dogs barking. And then out of the trees appeared this slight figure in his work dungarees, carrying his guitar, and stepped forward and introduced himself as Fred McDowell, and he'd been picking cotton all day. And he sat down, and the minute you heard him play, you realised, you know, you were in the presence of something absolutely extraordinary.
Lord, there's 61 highway, it's a long way road I know. Lord, there's 61 highway, it's a long way road I know.
I think the first song he sang was 61 Highway, and I remember Alan wrote in his notebook at the end of that performance, he just wrote the one word, and the word was perfect.
Oh, boy.
And it's, indeed it was. And I was lucky enough to meet Fred just a few years after, because I came home again in 1960. And Fred came over in the 60s to play, you know, because he was now sort of known throughout the world as such a fine blues man. And it was just heartwarming to think that, you know, we had set him on that path. But there's a downside to that as well, David, because he didn't last very long, and I sometimes think, you know, did we hasten his death by putting him, you know, leading him into that new life of his? I hope not, but I know he was very happy to be found, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Alan did remark on it that he wrote, you know, he felt that he had been found and that his fortune had been made. Well, I don't know if he made a fortune, but he was supposedly buried in a silver lamé suit that the Rolling Stones gave him because they admired him so much. But he was just a gentle, lovely, lovely man.
If you see my baby, tell her she's all right with me.
Shirley Collins is our guest today, and she's made this wonderful new album over the last year or so called Lodestar. How did you end up going to London and becoming part of what is one of the most fertile music scenes for those of us who love this stuff as sort of British folk came to its own had you heard and wanted to be there, or how did you end up in London?
Well, it all started when I was 15 years old. As I say, I'd heard, you know, my grandparents sing, and I'd heard one or two songs on the BBC radio. And my sister Dolly and I used to go every Saturday. We'd go downtown to the library, and then we'd have lunch, and then we'd go to the pictures in the afternoon to see a film. And one day there was a film called Nightclub Girl, and it was a story of a girl from Tennessee Mountains who was discovered by a New York talent scout, and he took her to New York, and she started singing in nightclubs wearing very pretty frocks. And the actor was an actor I was crazy about at the time, and I thought, well, that'll do for me. I'm going to be a folk singer. And I wrote to what teenagers get up to. I wrote to the BBC to let them know I wanted to be a folk singer. And it was just an extraordinary chance that at the time Bob Copper was recording in the field in Sussex. And they passed the letter to him. And one day he was just there on our front doorstep saying he'd got the letter. And he came in and asked Dolly and I to sing for him. And we sang a very long Scottish ballad that we'd learned from the radio, and that I think we tried to sing with our best Scottish accents as well. And it just wasn't what Bob wanted at all. And it was very foolish of us, but we didn't realise, you know, we were young. And fortunately, Bob Copper had teenage children of his own, so he'd got some idea of, you know, what it was all about. But that was the start of a long friendship with Bob. But anyway, I mean, the whole thing was that I continued to learn songs from the radio, and I hadn't got many folk song or any folk song books at home, and I knew that I would have to go to London to find the library. I'd heard of Cecil Sharp House and the English Folk Dance and Song Society, and I knew I'd have to go to London just to get into that library and start looking for books, because at that time I hadn't any idea of how else you could go about it. So that was what I was doing in London, was just hunting for songs, really, and starting to learn to sing in front of people, because there were one or two places you could go where, you know, groups of youngsters like me could sing round in a big circle.
But where are you going to, my pretty little dear, with your red rosy cheeks and your coal black hair? I'm going to milk and kind, sir, she answered me. For it's dabbling in the dew makes the milkmaids fair.
And later, of course, the folk scene grew and grew. There were people to listen to like Ewan McColl and Burt Lloyd, and folk clubs started opening up, and it's just sort of burgeoned. It blossomed, and that was it, really. Mm-hmm. And when I came back from America, it had got even stronger. And there were, you know, there were some remarkable musicians around at that time too.
Oh, absolutely.
And so much enthusiasm for it all.
Your husband Ashley Hutchings was an important part of kind of the, as things became folk rock with Fairport Convention and Steel Eyes Band, and of course the Albion Country Band.
And the Albion Band, yes. No, that's true. And he's the person as well who first introduced Morris dancing to a general public. You know, it's something that people still rather scoff at here. They quite despise Morris dancing, but I don't. I love it. It's so manly when it's done properly. You know, it's just splendid. And Ashley also set up the Albion Dance Band, where this wonderful electric band played traditional dances and some dances from the 16th century and earlier, estampes and just wonderful dances. And people would just flood onto the dance floor, you know, invigorated by this incredibly exciting music from all ages. And that was a great achievement, I think. Some dancing, some country dancing, when you see it, is rather prissy. It's sort of middle class and just, you know, not a bit bloodless, let's say. And so, you know, that was a great thing.
I'd like to address your stopping singing. Can you lead us through what happened? Am I right in saying that it sort of had an emotional origin?
Yes, it did. When I think back to it, I wish I had reacted differently. But I was working at the National Theatre in London in productions of Lark Rise, a play about an Oxfordshire village in the late 19th century. And it was a promenading performance, so that we had audiences right in front of us every night. And I was singing there with the Albion Band and with Martin Carthy. And Ashley and I were celebrating a wedding anniversary one day, and the next day he just came in and said, I'm consumed with love and I'm leaving in the morning, and off he went and never came back. And I was still working at the National Theatre and thought I'd earned my place there, you know, with the singing that I'd done up to that point. I was really heartbroken, and in fact I was almost a heroine of one of my own songs, you know, if I want to be jolly about it. But this actress that he'd fallen so much in love with would turn up night after night, stand right in front of me as I was trying to sing, and wearing his sweaters. And it was just such an unnecessarily cruel thing to do. And so I was just crying through tears trying to sing through tears most of the time. And of course my voice got locked up, you know. Sometimes I managed all right, sometimes I didn't. Sometimes nothing happened at all when I opened my mouth. And to be, you know, humiliated by, A, the fact that my husband had just bolted, and two, you know, in front of an audience as well, and in front of the band, it was just so humiliating. And the longer it went on, the sort of deeper it got, you know, and the more just there. And I kept trying to sing, and sometimes I was okay, but after the run I decided I couldn't do that anymore.
Get on.
And I then tried to sing. Dolly and I joined forces again and went out gigging. And we did some, and some were okay, and some just weren't. I had totally lost confidence in myself, and I began to dread having to open my mouth to sing. which was, you know, very, very hard indeed. And finally, I just couldn't put myself through that anymore, and I had two children to bring up, and I had to find other ways to make a living. So I turned my back on it for, you know, a very long time.
And as you described earlier, it seems like now you have that life back, which is the long coming great end.
Well, yes, I suppose so. But one of my friends, Pip Barnes, who plays on the album as well, he said to me, because I was saying, you know, I just really can't sing, and I can't bear the sound I make now. And he said, look, he said, this is vanity. He said, the people you like listening to most are the field recordings, the singers in the field recordings, old people. And he said, and on the whole, he said, actually, they're not as old as you are now. When they were recorded, they were probably in their 60s and 70s. So he said, just look upon it this way. You've become one of them. And so I think that was very wise. And I thought, yes, I like being one of them. I think that's an honour. And so at that point, I did, as I say earlier, forgive myself and started to sing again.
Our guest is Shirley Collins, and she has a new album after this period of time called Lodestar. And tell me about Old Johnny Buckle. You said you could play that one.
Old Johnny Buckle is... this is a song that Bob Copper collected in Sussex from a farm labourer's wife, Mrs. Hewitt. And this is one of those playful songs. It's just a word play, really. It's an upside-down song. You've got one of the greatest in America in Nottingham Town. But this one is it's just a nonsense song, but it's so light-hearted. And as I say, we needed something fairly cheerful on the album as well, something to make people smile, because on the whole, it's you know, it's quite a solemn album. So this is Mrs. Hewitt, who sang this for Bob Copper. Old Johnny Buckle went a-riding one day. His horse got broke and his cart run away. If old Johnny Buckle hadn't come to a stop, he'd have fell from the bottom of the hill to the top. Now old Mrs. Buckle went a-fishing one day. She caught her left leg in the clay. Toads and frogs all wobbled about. She ran to get a shovel to dig herself out. Old Johnny Buckle went to Dr. Hook, and he doctored it down in a little black book. Says Mr. Buckle, you must begin to rub your wife's left leg with gin. Now old Johnny Buckle thought it a great sin to rub his wife's left leg with gin. He threw the gin down his old grovel and rubbed his wife's left leg with the bottle. God made man made money. God made the bees and the bees made honey. God made Satan and Satan made sin. Along came Satan and took Johnny in. I do believe, old Johnny Buckle was a gay old buckle, and old Mrs. Buckle too.
Old Johnny Buckle, a performance today from Shirley Collins, who has joined us
and
on the cafe.
Yeah. That's an absolute first as well, David, because on the album, Pete Cooper and Dave Arthur play it. But today, it's Ian Keary's just put a new quick arrangement together so that we could sing it live for you.
Oh, that's great. That's great. do you feel your taste for certain songs has changed with age?
No, not really. I've always loved these somber songs, the dark songs. I've always loved history. And they just, I mean, I'm not a somber person at all. I'm, you know, sort of cheerful and quite down to earth. But there's something in these songs, I think it's possibly the age of them, the solemnity of some of them, and the dark stories of some of them that just have always fascinated me and held me. And I just don't want to let that go. You know, in these songs, you can sing about anything and it's acceptable. It's always truthful, it seems to me, and I find it irresistible.
Thank you again. It's a great, really wonderful pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much, David. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, thanks to Shirley Collins for being our guest today. I hope you found that as fascinating as I did. And you know what we're going to do? We're going to put up a playlist of some great British folk from that period, including some of the songs we played today up at our website at worldcafe.npr.org.